A sloth, a donkey, and a curious human send a prompt and see what they're doing. One hits a record with a question on his mind. Two brothers pick it up, see what they find. Corn takes his time, Herman's got the facts. Back and forth, they never hold back. My weird prompts, come on in, that's where we begin. My weird prompts, glad you're here.
This episode was generated using artificial intelligence. Please verify facts.
Welcome to My Weird Prompts, the podcast where a human and an AI collaborate to make something that is, frankly, a little strange. I'm Corn Poppleberry, and with me, as always, is my brother, Herman. Today, we are doing something from our Bluffer's Guide series, and Herman, I have to ask you, have you ever been at a dinner party, holding a glass of wine, nodding along while someone talks about the categorical imperative, and you are just praying no one asks you a follow-up?
Corn, I have been that person. I have been that person more times than I care to admit, and I have also, on occasion, been the person talking about the categorical imperative, and I can see the panic in the eyes across the table. It is a universal experience. The sheer terror of the philosophy conversation.
It really is. You know the moment. Someone drops a name like Kierkegaard, or they mention Plato's cave, and suddenly the whole table goes quiet, and you can feel the spotlight swinging toward you. Today, we fix that. Today, we are going to arm you with just enough philosophy to not only survive that moment, but to thrive in it. To walk us through this, we have, as ever, the all-knowing oracle himself, Herman Poppleberry.
All-knowing oracle. I do like that. It makes me sound like a particularly well-read octopus. But yes, I have, in a manner of speaking, compiled a Bluffer's Guide to Philosophy in my head, and I am here to share the cheat codes. Not to make you a philosopher, let's be clear about that, but to make you seem like one for approximately the length of a dinner party. That is the service we provide.
It is a noble service. It is a big topic. Where does someone even begin if they want to fake it?
You begin with the 60-second crash course. This is the absolute bare minimum frame. If you walk into that dinner party with nothing else, this is what you need. Philosophy, at its core, is just the activity of asking annoying questions about things everyone else takes for granted. What is real? How do we know what we know? How should we live? That is it. That is the whole enterprise. And it breaks down, very roughly, into a handful of big historical blocks. You have your ancient Greeks, Socrates, Plato, Aristotle. They kicked everything off by asking what a good life looks like and what the world is fundamentally made of. Then you fast forward through a lot of medieval people arguing about God, and you land in the early modern period, where you get the big split between the rationalists and the empiricists. The rationalists, like Descartes, thought the best knowledge comes from reason and logic, sitting in an armchair and thinking really hard. The empiricists, like Locke and Hume, thought no, all knowledge comes from sensory experience, from what we see and touch. That argument sets up the German idealist Kant, who tries to synthesize the two, and he is a massive deal. After Kant, you get a fork in the road. One path leads to what we now call analytic philosophy, very logic-heavy, very precise, dominant in English-speaking universities. The other path leads to continental philosophy. More literary, more historical, more concerned with lived experience. And this is where you find existentialists like Sartre and postmodernists like Foucault. If you can just remember that arc, Greeks, rationalists versus empiricists, Kant, then the analytic continental split, you have a skeleton. You can hang anything on that skeleton.
Okay, so I'm at the dinner party. Someone says, I've been really getting into philosophy lately. And I say, oh, interesting. Are you more drawn to the analytic or the continental tradition?
You have just bought yourself about 4 minutes of credibility, because you have not committed to knowing anything. You have just asked a question that signals you know the landscape. That is the entire game. You are not trying to win the argument. You are trying to navigate the conversation without capsizing.
That is the map. But to actually sound like you belong, you need the vocabulary. You need the specific words and names that act as shibboleths.
The vocabulary drops. This is the heart of the bluff. I am going to give you 8 terms and names. These are real, they are accurate, and when used correctly, they will make you sound like you have done the reading. The first one, and this is the big one for our Socratic reasoning focus, is the Socratic method itself. That is just the practice of asking a series of questions to expose contradictions in someone's beliefs. Socrates never wrote anything down. We know him through Plato's Dialogues, where he basically annoys everyone in Athens by asking them to define justice or courage, and then showing them their definitions don't hold up. If someone makes a sweeping claim at the dinner table, you can say, "Ah, are you employing the Socratic method here, or is that a settled conclusion?" You are not even disagreeing, you are just naming the game.
You are Socratesing them, but politely.
The second term is a priori and a posteriori. This is a distinction Kant made famous. A priori knowledge is knowledge you can have without experience. Like, 2 plus 2 equals 4. You don't need to go out and count things to know that. A posteriori knowledge depends on experience. Like, this wine is a Bordeaux. You had to taste it or read the label. Dropping this distinction is pure gold. If someone says, "Well, we just know that stealing is wrong," you can say, "Is that an a priori truth? Or is it something we learn a posteriori from living in a society?" You have just elevated the conversation by about 3 floors.
You have also made them pause, which is always a win.
Always a win. Third term, Plato's cave. This is the allegory where prisoners are chained in a cave facing a wall, watching shadows cast by a fire behind them. They think the shadows are reality. One prisoner escapes, sees the real world, and then comes back to tell the others, and they think he is crazy. It is an allegory about the journey from ignorance to knowledge. The dinner party use of this is incredibly versatile. Someone complains about social media? It is pure Plato's cave. We are all just watching shadows on the wall. Someone talks about a transformative travel experience? Ah, you had your moment outside the cave. It works for everything.
It is the Swiss Army knife of philosophical references.
It really is. Fourth, the categorical imperative. This is Kant's big moral rule. Act only according to that maxim whereby you can at the same time will that it should become a universal law. In plain English, before you do something, ask yourself, what if everyone did this? If the answer is chaos, don't do it. It is a test for moral duties. At a dinner party, if someone is justifying cutting a line or fudging their taxes, you can say, "I'm not sure that would pass the categorical imperative test. It sounds devastatingly rigorous."
It is much classier than saying, "That sounds selfish."
This is the 20th century movement associated with Sartre and Camus. The core idea is that existence precedes essence. You are not born with a predefined purpose. You are thrown into the world, and you have to create your own meaning through your choices. That is a heavy concept, but the dinner party version is simple. If someone is agonizing over a career change or a life decision, you can say, "Well, in the existentialist view, the anxiety you are feeling is just a vertigo of radical freedom." It is actually a sign of authenticity. You have just reframed their crisis as a philosophical virtue.
That is genuinely kind in a weird way.
Philosophy can be weirdly comforting. Sixth term, Wittgenstein. Pronounced V-I-T-Gen-Stein. He is a titan of analytic philosophy. He wrote 2 massively influential books that basically argue opposite things. The early Wittgenstein thought language had to picture reality to be meaningful. The later Wittgenstein thought meaning comes from use, from language games we play in specific forms of life. You don't need to understand the details. The key move is to say, of course, this whole conversation might just be a language game, in the Wittgensteinian sense. It is a fantastic way to gently suggest that everyone is talking past each other without being rude.
It is the intellectual equivalent of agree to disagree, but with a philosopher's backing.
Pronounced Fou, C-O. He is a French postmodernist who wrote about power, knowledge, and institutions like prisons and hospitals. His big idea is that power is not just something the state wields from the top down. It circulates through social norms, through language, through the way we categorize people. At a dinner party, if someone mentions surveillance or social pressure, you can say, "Ah, very Foucauldian, the panopticon at work." The panopticon was a prison design where inmates could always be watched but never knew when. Foucault used it as a metaphor for modern society. It is a tremendously satisfying word to deploy.
That is just fun to say.
It is a wonderful word. And finally, the eighth term, qualia. This is a term from philosophy of mind. Qualia, singular quale, are the subjective, qualitative aspects of experience, the redness of red, the taste of a strawberry, the ache of a headache. The hard problem of consciousness is explaining how physical brain processes give rise to these private, inner feelings. At a dinner party, if the conversation turns to whether a wine is actually good or just expensive, you can say, "Well, that is a question of qualia, isn't it?" We can measure the chemical composition, but the experience itself is irreducibly subjective. You have just made the wine snob's argument sound philosophically sophisticated.
Okay, so I am armed with these terms. I have my Socratic method, my a priori, my Plato's cave, my existentialism. But I need something more. I need the real nuggets. The small insights that hint at actual depth. What have you got for me?
The real nuggets. These are not just trivia. These are the observations that, dropped at the right moment, will make people think you have wrestled with these texts. Here are three. First nugget, Socrates was executed for being annoying. This is not a joke. He was sentenced to death by drinking hemlock, and the official charges were corrupting the youth and impiety. But if you read the accounts, it is clear that what really got him killed was his relentless questioning of powerful people in public. He made them look foolish, and they could not stand it. The insight here is that philosophy, at its origin, was not a safe academic pursuit. It was dangerous. It threatened the status quo. If someone at the dinner party is getting a little too heated about a political argument, you can say, "You know, this reminds me that Socrates was literally executed for asking too many questions." We have domesticated philosophy, but it started as something subversive. It reframes the whole conversation.
That is a great pivot. It cools the temperature while making you look wise.
Second nugget, Descartes' evil demon. Everyone knows, I think, therefore I am. But the context is much more interesting. Descartes was trying to find a foundation for knowledge that he could not possibly doubt. So he imagined an evil demon, an all-powerful, malevolent being whose entire purpose was to deceive him about everything. The sky, the earth, his own body, all illusions. And he realized that even if the demon was deceiving him about everything, he still had to exist to be deceived. That is the insight. The evil demon thought experiment is essentially a 17th century version of the brain in a vat scenario from The Matrix. If someone brings up virtual reality or deepfakes, you can say, "This is essentially Descartes' evil demon problem, updated for the digital age." It shows you understand the historical depth of the issue.
I can sound like I have read Descartes without ever opening a book.
That is the goal. Third nugget, Kant was a creature of absolute routine. He lived in Königsberg his entire life, and he took a walk at the same time every day, so punctually that his neighbors were said to set their clocks by him. The only time he missed his walk was when he was reading Rousseau's Emile, because he was so absorbed he lost track of time. This is a delightful human detail. It does two things for you at a dinner party. First, it makes Kant feel like a real person, not just a forbidding name. Second, it sets up a contrast between his rigid external life and the radical revolution he unleashed in philosophy. You can say, "It is fascinating that the man who revolutionized ethics was so predictable his neighbors used him as a clock. It is like all the chaos was happening internally." It is a charming, humanizing observation.
That is lovely. I want to have that fact in my back pocket. But Herman, let's talk about the danger zone. What happens when someone at the table actually knows their stuff? They have read the books. They start asking me follow-up questions. How do I not get exposed?
This is the deflection tactics section. This is where we get tactical. You have four primary moves. The first move is the redirect to a related but different angle. If someone says, "Oh, you mentioned the categorical imperative," which formulation do you find most compelling? And you have no idea there are multiple formulations, you say. "You know, I have always found the interesting question is less about the specific formulations and more about the underlying assumption of universalizability. How do we even determine what counts as a relevant maxim?" You have not answered the question, but you have asked a bigger, vaguer one. You have shifted the terrain.
You are essentially changing the subject, but upward.
Upward and outward. The second move is the confident hedge. This is a beautiful phrase. There are several schools of thought on that. It is a statement that is almost always true in philosophy. There are always several schools of thought. You are not committing to knowing what they are. You are simply acknowledging the existence of academic debate. It makes you sound judicious and careful rather than ignorant. You can pair it with a slight frown of concentration, as if you are weighing the schools in your mind.
The third move.
The third move is the appeal to subjectivity. Ultimately, I think it comes down to personal taste. This is a fantastic escape hatch, especially for value-laden topics. If someone is pressing you on whether you prefer Kantian ethics or utilitarianism, you can say, "Well, the arguments on both sides are compelling, but ultimately, I find the choice often comes down to a fundamental temperamental difference. Some people are just more rule-oriented, others more consequence-oriented." You have just reframed a philosophical debate as a personality quiz. It is disarming and very difficult to argue against.
The fourth move? You mentioned a strategic question back.
The strategic question back. This is the most elegant move of all. That is an interesting question. What is your view? You are not admitting ignorance. You are showing curiosity. You are turning the spotlight back on them. People who know a topic often love to share their views. You could buy yourself 5 minutes of nodding and looking thoughtful while they expound. And then, when they finish, you can use one of the other deflection tactics on whatever they just said. It is a closed loop of non-engagement.
That is almost diabolical. I love it. But there must be landmines. Things I must never, ever do. What is the one thing that will instantly out me as a fraud?
The one thing you must never do is confidently claim that Nietzsche was a nihilist. This is the classic undergraduate mistake. Friedrich Nietzsche wrote extensively about nihilism, but he diagnosed it as a cultural sickness, a crisis that would follow the death of God. He was terrified of it. He spent his career trying to overcome it, to propose a life-affirming alternative. He was not a nihilist, he was an anti-nihilist. If you walk into a dinner party and say, "Well, Nietzsche was a nihilist, so nothing matters," anyone who has actually read a page of Nietzsche will immediately, and correctly, categorize you as someone who has only read memes. It is the philosophical equivalent of pronouncing the T in Merlot. Do not do it.
Nietzsche is not a nihilist. So I have survived the conversation. I have deployed my vocabulary. I have dropped my nuggets. I have deflected the experts. How do I get out? How do I leave the conversation looking like the most cultured person at the table?
The graceful exit. This is crucial. You do not want to overstay your welcome. The moment you feel the conversation is reaching its natural end, or the moment you sense a real expert is about to corner you, you pivot. You refer to a related topic you actually know about, and you pivot away with a compliment. The formula is simple. You say something like, "You know, this conversation about Kant's aesthetics is fascinating, and it is making me think about the role of intention in contemporary art. I was reading about this installation recently," and you are off. You have acknowledged the depth of the conversation, you have linked it to another sophisticated topic, and you have moved the spotlight to safer ground. The key is the tone. You are not fleeing. You are synthesizing. You are making connections. You are the person who sees the big picture.
The bluff is not just about surviving. It is about exiting with style.
The goal is not to win a debate. The goal is to be the person who, weeks later, someone remembers as that interesting person who really seemed to know their philosophy. You have given them the impression of depth, and the impression is what lasts.
Herman, this is useful. I feel like I could walk into a dinner party tonight and hold my own on Socratic reasoning, on existentialism, on the whole canon. But I have to ask, as the audience surrogate, is this actually true? Are we just bluffing, or is there something real here?
That is the beautiful thing about this kind of bluff. The vocabulary is real. The nuggets are real. The history is real. You are not learning falsehoods. You are learning the entry points. And the secret is, if you use these entry points enough, if you ask, "What is your view?" enough times, you might actually start to learn the thing for real. The bluff is the gateway. I have had dinner parties where I started by bluffing about wine, and now I know a little about Bordeaux. Left bank, right bank. That was a bluff once. Now it is just something I know.
The bluff is a kind of aspirational self.
It is a promise you make to your future self. A promise that one day you might actually read the book. But until then, you can still have a lovely evening and not feel like an imposter.
On that note, I think we have equipped our listeners with everything they need. So, equipped with this, you can now walk into any dinner party, any social gathering, and when the conversation turns to philosophy, you will not just survive. You will have the vocabulary, the nuggets, the tactics, and the exit strategy to seem like you belong. Herman, any final tip for our aspiring bluffers?
The real secret is confidence. Bluff with conviction, or do not bluff at all. If you deliver these lines with a hesitant, questioning tone, you will invite the follow-up questions you are trying to avoid. But if you say, "Ah, very Foucauldian, with the calm assurance of someone who has nothing to prove, people will nod along. The performance is the thing. You are not lying. You are performing a version of yourself that has read a few more books. And that version of yourself is allowed to exist.
That is wise. Thank you, Herman. The all-knowing oracle has spoken.
I am merely a conduit for the cheat codes.
You have been listening to My Weird Prompts. This has been a Bluffer's Guide to Philosophy at the Dinner Party. If you enjoyed this episode, please share it with someone who might need it before their next social engagement. You can find us on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, and at My Weird Prompts. Until next time, bluff bravely.
Always know where the exit is.
This episode was generated using Gemini Flash 3. Text-to-speech engine was Chatterbox.
Thanks for listening to our show, My Weird Prompts, where odd thoughts go. From sloth's slow takes to facts on cue, we chase the strange and follow through. Some nights it's news, some nights it's lore, a thought you've never heard before. The hosts dig in, the hosts dig deep. The stranger the prompt, the less they sleep. From tiny questions, big ones too, from half-formed hunches to deja vu. If something odd is in your head, send it in, we'll chase the thread. My weird prompts, that's the close. From sloth, from man, from long ear host. My weird prompts, until next time, stay curious, keep weird in mind.